WUKY presents health news you can use. It's Dr. Greg Davis on medicine.
We have come a long way in the profession of medicine, and women now make up more than 50% of medical students. However, we still have a long way to go. Dr. Annie Kemple is an anthropologist on the research team at the American Board of Family Medicine. Annie, I really appreciate you talking with me today. I was really intrigued and learned from a study that you and a colleague engaged in recently looking at unrecognized and uncompensated leadership roles of women in medicine. I guess we've come a long way in the last couple of generations in medicine, but we still have a long way to go. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, thanks so much for talking to me, Greg. I really appreciate the opportunity. There's been a lot of research done recently looking at the gender pay gap in medicine. And despite the majority now of medical school students being women, I believe in 2024, 2025, the number was something like 56% of medical school students were women. There is still a significant wage gap in medicine. A recent study showed that over a woman's lifetime, somewhere between $2 to $4 million would be earned less by women compared to their male colleagues. So it adds up over time. And additionally, there are significantly fewer women in leadership positions in medicine, again, despite their growing role as physicians and other providers in healthcare. I can't remember any of those numbers, but it is just like dismally small across both hospital and clinical level, but then also in academic medicine, a very small proportion of deans and other leaders are women. So there's a real problem here, and we've known the numbers for a while. But as an anthropologist, I really wanted to get an idea of how people were experiencing these numbers and what the story was behind these numbers. So I interviewed 25 early career family physicians who self-identified as women. And they were about 3 to 5 years out of residency. So I was really curious their experiences navigating their first job out of residency, and then some of the barriers they encountered as women in medicine in their first or second job, because some of them had left their first job since by the time I interviewed them. And I asked them about their goals for leadership positions, what they wanted to do with their careers. And overwhelmingly, the women I spoke with were not interested in a leadership position for really three main reasons. First, they found leadership roles that are compensated to be heavily bureaucratic and disciplinary. And they found that really off-putting. They wanted to be a leader who was collaborative, who emphasized community, and there were no properly compensated roles that honored those values. They also said they already engaged in leadership positions, and these were positions that reflected their values. So for example, women overwhelmingly are mentoring younger women in how to navigate some of the barriers in medicine, and finding inefficiencies in workflow and spending out of office time teaching other people how to better use their electronic health record. They're not being paid extra for mentoring or for teaching these skills. And then third, there was a tension between work and family life, but that tension was not something that prevented them from wanting to pursue leadership. If anything, they found a lot of support from their families that was often lacking in the institutions they worked for. So that's just to kind of recognize that, yes, women are still working full-time at home on top of their full-time job at work, but that didn't really play into their calculation of whether they wanted to go into leadership.
Well, you know, and I've always found it ironic in this current economic medical model in the United States that on the one hand, we part of our Hippocratic oath that we swear upon graduating is that we're going to train the generation coming after us, that we recognize and honor our teachers whom we depended on when we were coming up through undergrad and medical school and postgraduate training, and that we have an obligation to honor our students and other learners and bring them up just as we were. And yet there's so much pressure on physicians to crank it out, to see that next patient, and to take the time to mentor somebody, which we all need to do. is actually economically, potentially economically harmful to that family physician or any other physician. It's sort of a lose-lose proposition the way our system is built.
Yes, and so much of our healthcare system focuses on the profit motive, and out of that emerges this fetishism of efficiency and productivity. And yeah, that leads to even beyond just the mentorship challenge, the compensation models being based off of being more efficient from an economic perspective. So getting through patients as quickly as you can because you're compensated based on how many value units you can produce, rather than taking a different approach that allows the physician to spend more time with the patient and may actually be more cost effective in the long term, and would also leave more time for mentorship, would leave more time to spend time in the clinic setting with students and patients. And there's also research that shows women tend to spend more time with their patients in the clinic setting, and they have better outcomes from that. And they have higher patient satisfaction, but they're earning less. That is not the main cause of the gender wage gap, but it's kind of one of the many contributing factors is that payment system. So yeah, the entire way our system is set up is meant to make it extremely difficult for women and extremely difficult to care for younger generations who are coming up through the system.
As an anthropologist, are you seeing any groundswell of a desire for a solution to this issue? Are there organizations, are there paths that early career physicians might take that can break this mold, if you will?
There is, that's such a big question. There definitely is so much interest in changing the system, but I think, your experience may be more enlightening on this front, but there's such a sense of isolation among physicians starting in residency or starting in med school through residency into practice, this sense of, I need to be the one with the solution. And if I don't have the solution, I get really frustrated and I don't know what to do. And so there's a desire to change the system, but uncertainty about what changing the system would look like. I will say I've been having over the past few months on another project, a lot of conversations about how both patients and physicians want to work together to implement solutions and what that might look like. And what the role of boards would be in that, what the role of the American Board of Medical Specialties that oversees all the boards would be, what the role of the American Medical Association should be. I guess just how to break that sense of isolation and build more collaboration, not only among physicians, but with patients and physicians, because neither are benefiting from the system. And I think that also ties back to the women in leadership, who they tend to value collaboration and solidarity and community. So I think these two things are related. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, I think you did. And, in what is it, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, one of the main things we all want is recognition. And for so many of these women physicians who want leadership roles but feel they can't do it, part of that might be just because of the lack of recognition. I'm thinking of some friends of mine who do an amazing amount of mentorship, whose doors are figuratively and literally open almost all the time to medical students, to resident physicians, to early career faculty members, and yet they are not recognized for all of this work. It's almost like an underground economy that's unpaid.
Yes. And I also kind of always struggle, like, how do we get those people paid? Like, how do we recognize them for that incredible job that they're doing? But then also, how do we use that to put pressure on the system or put pressure on institutions, whether that's hospital corporations or insurance companies, to work better for everyone?
Yeah. You know, I think you and I talked offline about this, you know, anecdotes aren't science, but I think about on more than one occasion, friends of mine in medicine have counseled early career physicians, med students, residents, maybe who are thinking of leaving medicine. Maybe they had real struggles with work-life balance or were undergoing some anxiety and depression, which so many of us in medicine have struggled with at one point or another. And through that mentorship, through that empathic collaboration, saved the professional life of multiple individuals. And yet that too is unrecognized. And I don't know what the solutions are, but it's got to be something better than what we've been doing.
Yes. Yes. And I also, I get so lost in, like, I would love to see physicians, regardless of their gender, race, age, fairly compensated. I would also love to see all patients have not just access to healthcare, but have healthcare that doesn't financially ruin them, that isn't a 12-month wait. But it's easy for me to get lost in how do we get there and the what do we do in the meantime? Like, what are the first steps? And I guess, like, the only thing I settle on is just talking to each other more about it, especially physicians. Like, whenever we touch on these topics in interviews, they're always, like, so frustrated and clearly want to be talking about these things and talking about how broken the system is, and they want to implement solutions and they want to make change. But they often hadn't really had this conversation before, unless they were part of a physician union. Sometimes those conversations would come up. And so I don't know, I guess just, like, the first step is just increasing the amount that we're talking about it, as much as that feels so unsatisfying. Like, yeah, just talking about something isn't making a change. But again, the amount of isolation in healthcare means that, like, it's not, I don't know.
Well, we have to define a problem and be aware of it before we can address it and find solutions for it. I mean, and I guess I have a kernel of hope, because we've come a really long way since my generation of medical students. You know, the sort of the philosophy 40 years ago when I was in medical school was suck it up, and if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen, which is one of the foundational reasons why physicians have some of the highest rates of substance use disorder, failed relationships, you know, that mental illness. And I think recognizing that that was devastating our profession has really helped over the last couple of generations. So maybe there is a little bit of hope on the horizon.
Yeah. Also, when we were talking offline, you kind of brought up you mentioned something about professionalism, and that's another study I've been working on, and also differentiating between what individual professionalism looks like and what organizational professionalism looks like. And really trying to target institutions, again, whether that's the hospital or the insurance company, getting them to support the physician-patient relationship as a key part of physician professionalism.
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, you know, yeah, part of professionalism might be, am I dressed appropriately? Am I using the right language with, am I backing up my colleagues? But that professionalism goes both ways. The administration needs to recognize, honor, and compensate the physicians in their care, and I use that term advisedly. It is a two-way street, and insurance companies need to honor the knowledge and training of a physician who recommends a certain diagnostic or therapeutic procedure and not delay, deny, and all those other things that we know insurance companies do.
Yes. And when the context is leading physicians to have substance abuse issues or to be burned out or develop depression, anxiety, like, that's not on the individual physician to fix or deal with on their own. That should be, we need to put that back onto the organization and be like, you need to fix this because this is not sustainable.
Well, gosh, yeah. I mean, I forget who said, nobody's more cynical than a disappointed idealist. And I think of all these young people coming into medicine with a burning desire to help other people, who are willing to sacrifice. I mean, the pre-med and medical school curriculum is not easy. and it's a huge sacrifice. And then to come across what you and I have been talking about can really burst that bubble of idealism.
Yes.
But it's heartening to know that folks such as you are out there, again, identifying and trying to find ways to address this problem. Do you see, you know, before we part, do you see some solutions on the horizon in your organization and others?
I remain hopeful because of the amount of support and encouragement that not only myself, but other researchers have gotten to look into this topic and to, again, to talk about it more, as unsatisfying as that is. And I am also becoming more hopeful that some of the bigger medical organizations will start stepping up to the plate. Again, like American Medical Association, American Board of Medical Specialties. I think there is a growing recognition that addressing that organizational professionalism is incredibly important, and that especially in our current political environment, medicine needs to reassert itself as a profession. So I'm hopeful, but I think some of the more how those organizations will step up and what that will look like is probably above my my pay grade. But I'm hopeful by the way even conversations have changed over the last year.
So not to put words in your mouth, but maybe we can both be cautiously optimistic. Yeah.
Yes.
My thanks today to Dr. Annie Kemple, anthropologist on the research team at the American Board of Family Medicine, for talking with us about women in medicine often filling unrecognized and uncompensated leadership roles. For more information, visit our website at wuky.org. With health news you can use, I'm Dr. Greg Davis on Medicine.
Dr. Greg Davis is a forensic pathologist and professor emeritus at the University of Kentucky who volunteers his time covering important medical news for our community. This program is available as a podcast at wuky.org.